From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers says our economy is stuck, not just in a sticky, slow, cyclical downturn that will cycle back up. Maybe something deeper and worse. Secular stagnation is his economist's term for it. His solution, and this from a political centrist who helped tear down U.S. financial regulation, looks very Keynesian. More big public spending on American infrastructure now, or else trouble. This hour on Point, Larry Summers on what it's really going to take to revive the U.S. economy. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you see an economy that still needs extraordinary measures? Like what? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now in the studio is Larry Summers, economic advisor to two presidents, Treasury Secretary under Bill Clinton, director of the White House National Economic Council for Barack Obama, former president of Harvard University, where he's still a professor, managing partner, now a consultant at the hedge fund D.E. Shaw, former chief economist at the World Bank. Larry Summers, welcome back to On Point.
Glad to be with you.
You've been making a lot of noise at a lot of economic gatherings about secular stagnation and deep problems still in the U.S. economy, maybe the global economy. What's the heart of your case?
It's been a long time since we had healthy, strong economic growth in a full capacity economy. We solved, we addressed, we prevented the financial crisis of 2008-2009 from becoming a depression. But since 2009, it's been 4.5 years since the recession ended, and the share of American adults who are working is essentially where it was at the trough. The output level has not really kept up with natural population growth and normal productivity growth. The reality is that if you look before this crisis, yes, economic growth was reasonably satisfactory from 2004 to 2007, but that was only in the face of the mother of all credit bubbles, the huge bubble that took place in housing, vast erosion of lending standards. Before that, we had a recession. And so the reality is that our ability to have reasonable economic growth along with reasonable financial conditions is in question. And that's why I think there are quite profound policy challenges going forward.
The way out?
Look, there are a number of ways of responding to this situation, which, by the way, I talked about in the American context, Tom, but it's a context that really exists in Europe or and Japan to a very substantial extent, with Europe facing the prospect of deflation and Japan struggling to come out of a decade of deflation. There are really three ways of responding to the problem. One, which I think is the worst, is to simply hope for the best and not do much. Consequence of doing that is that eventually you'll close your output gap. But the way you'll close your output gap is that the economy's potential will come down.
Explain what you mean by output gap and closing it.
What we've had basically for years is an economy that's been underachieving. It's got the capacity to produce much more output than it has produced.
Oh, so just let it
kind of. There hadn't been enough demand.
Mm-hmm.
And so people don't produce more meals in the restaurant because only so many people come in. Mm-hmm. And eventually, if we don't do anything, we'll have less and less investment. More and more people will give up on the idea of being workers.
Just a weaker, and poorer economy.
And we'll be a poorer, weaker economy, but at least we'll be up to our potential. It'll just be a much lower potential.
Okay.
That's got to be a terrible way.
Let's say that's not real attractive.
That's got to be a terrible way to respond. A second way to respond, and it's certainly better than doing nothing, is by trying as hard as we can to create as loose and liquid financial conditions as we possibly can, so as to cause asset prices to go up and make people feel wealthy, so as to encourage as much borrowing as can possibly take place.
Isn't this what we've been doing? Look at interest rates.
But the danger there is that it's better than just leaving people to be unemployed. but it runs the risk of reigniting the kinds of problems we had between 2005 and 2007.
Bubbles.
Bubbles, and then bubbles that burst. There's the problem that just how good is the investment that people were not willing to make when the interest rate was 2%, but are willing to make if we can drive down the interest rate to a lower level. And as illustrated by the fact that there's $2.5 trillion of cash sitting on corporate balance sheets, simply sterile, not doing anything, there's a question as to just how effective these kinds of policies are going to be.
The second path.
I approve of the attempt, but I think there are real limits both of efficacy and of potentially toxic side effects.
Just for clarity, the second path sounds like the path we're on. And this has been...
That's broadly been the strategy that
interest rates couldn't be lower. There's been a whole lot of transfusion from the Fed going
on. Yeah, we've pulled back on it. We've pulled back on it a bit. But broadly, that's been the strategy. The third strategy, which I think is the one we've been doing actually in the wrong direction for the last 3 years, is to try to directly stimulate spending, not by reducing interest rates, but by stimulating a higher level of spending at any given level of interest rates. And here it seems to me the strongest candidate is public investment. Look at Kennedy Airport. Nobody can be proud of Kennedy Airport as the gateway to the greatest city in the greatest country.
It's old now, it's falling apart.
It's old, it's falling apart. No place you fly to from Kennedy Airport is frankly as decrepit as Kennedy Airport. And I would just ask the question, if a moment when we can borrow money for the long term in a currency we print below 3%, and a moment when construction unemployment is just about in double digits, if that's not the moment to fix Kennedy Airport, when would that moment ever be? And that's... And that's a question that applies to infrastructure investment much more broadly in our country.
Like what?
We talk about science and technology education, but across the country, kids get sick in their chemistry lab because nobody has the budget to fix the ventilation system. We talk about the importance of education, but as one teacher some years ago in Oakland said to me, we tell our kids that their education is the most important thing. But then we let the paint chip off the walls in this classroom. Why should they believe us? It's a legitimate question. We can't run a train system between New York, Boston, and Washington, the urban heart of the East Coast of our country, where the trains are able to stay on schedule, even when that schedule is only half as ambitious as the schedule that would exist in France or the schedule that would exist in Japan. It's much more common than it used to be that people experience power outages when there's a storm. The cell phone service, Tom, between my office at Harvard and me sitting in a car is better if I'm going from the Beijing airport into Beijing than it is if I'm going into Logan Airport into Boston. Those are all examples of inadequate infrastructure that holds back economic growth. And here's the remarkable thing. If we invested more in infrastructure, it would pretty much pay for itself. It would pretty much pay for itself because it would stimulate demand and increase economic growth. It would pretty much pay for itself because it would increase the supply potential of the economy in the long run, cell phones that work. It would pay for itself because we're going to have to do it sometime. Kennedy Airport isn't going to go unrepaired forever. And the longer we let it sit, the more expensive it's going to be to fix.
Would it fix the problem, the fundamental economic problem, or just give us some years of reprieve and then we're back in it because something deeper is wrong?
It would go a long way. And the task of renewing and renovating the infrastructure is a task that will be with us always. For one generation, it was the Transcontinental Railroad. For another generation, it was the Panama Canal. For another generation, it was the interstate highway system. For our generation, it's been everything associated with broadband and wireless and information technology.
But of course,
who's to know for sure what it will be for the next generation?
But everybody's worried about debt and deficit, and here we go deeper with this. A low interest rate, but nevertheless, this is deficit spending you're talking about.
So, Tom, respectfully, I think that is a deep confusion. If a corporate management borrows money, it burdens the future of the company.
Mm-hmm.
If a corporate management defers all the maintenance, that burdens the future just as much. If a corporate management underfunds the pension plan, that burdens the just as much. If a corporate management does no R&D, so there's no pipeline of new products, that burdens the future of our country. And we've had a political debate that has been hijacked by debt concept in a much too restrictive way.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers about the U.S. economy and what it's going to take to really get it in gear again, whether we are stuck, and if we are, what to do about it. Larry Summers is with me in the studio. And Larry, I've got a lot of questions for you, but so do our listeners. Let's go right to Ann Arbor, Michigan. John is calling. John, you're on the air with Larry Summers.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier, you asked a question that I thought was a very good one that relates to the question I want to ask. And you asked the question about, is there deeper things going on here? My question is the following. Could the slowdown in growth and falling productivity trends reflect the fact that in our finite world, we are increasingly running into the limits of growth as foreseen by the Club of Rome over 40 years ago and as dramatically illustrated by the arrival of peak oil?
Larry Summers, lots of questions online along these lines. John in Ann Arbor, thank you for yours. Here's another. Josh writes on Facebook, says, infinite growth is not possible. I wish we could start talking about positive and sustainable economic circumstances. Lots of people asking about environmental issues, climate change, and limits that may be staring at us there. John's going all the way back to Club of Rome and limits to growth. What about that way of looking at the world today?
It may well be that the most memorable error that our generation has made is the failure to deal with climate change. It is a huge and still substantially unmet challenge, and it should preoccupy every one of us. I do not think it's plausible to link the economic problems we've been talking about, which go to a sudden drop in growth and a sudden drop in employment over the last 4 or 5 years, to environmental scarcities of various kinds. The onset is much too sudden with the financial crisis and the collapse of Lehman. That's a sudden onset. These kinds of environmental problems have been growing for a long time.
Is there a contradiction?
If you actually caller referred to peak oil,
mm-hmm.
what's actually stunning is
yeah.
that we've got exactly the opposite. The United States has emerged in the last couple of years as the world's largest oil producer. North America is going to be energy independent by 2020. What is stunning in the last few years is just how large the discoveries of energy have been, just how far natural gas prices have fallen. So I take environmental concerns enormously seriously as an issue for the future. I think President Obama led the world in making a commitment in 2009, which was, in my view, a hugely important commitment to eliminate fossil fuel subsidies everywhere around the world. That commitment has not yet been redeemed, and I think it's something that's very, very important. So I agree on the importance of the environmental dimension. I think peak oil increasingly appears as a ludicrous idea, and I don't think that connects with the loss of jobs and production over the last 5 years, though certainly if we don't do anything, we're going to have very serious economic problems because of environmental problems in the future.
Well, here's my question then, more fundamentally maybe. Do you see a contradiction between renewing growth, reviving growth, and addressing climate change?
No. I actually see...
A lot of people think renewed growth and they think snorting diesel engines and resource consumption and water we don't have and limits.
I actually think that's a very, very dangerous idea. I think it's a dangerous idea because if it were ever accepted, people would give up on environmental improvement because they're not going to give up on the idea of higher living standards. They're not going to give up on the idea of economic growth. You know, if you look at different countries, very consistently, as countries get richer, their environment improves.
China?
China's environment.
You can't see 2 feet in Beijing. I've seen the photos.
China's environment will be better 10 years from now than it is today, and China's environment will improve more rapidly if they have the economic growth that gives the wherewithal to invest in environmental protection. You know, if you look at the American environment, there are far more trees here in New England than there were in 1900.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at smog in American cities, it's down by 90%. That is a reflection of the fact that we've become a more prosperous society and therefore we're able to afford environmental investment and we demand more environmental investment. Environmental investment and economic growth go together.
John in Ann Arbor, thanks for your call. Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Lionel. Lionel, you're on the air with Larry Summers.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Larry. He laid out a brilliant plan for infrastructure development, and we know this is why a lot of people voted for Obama, because we thought that he had the end on what it would take to get the economy going and put everybody to work, and by improving our dilapidated and infrastructure. Why hasn't it happened? That's the question. Why hasn't that happened? Everybody knows it. It's plain as the nose on my face, and nothing has happened.
Larry Summers, the president said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to spend a lot of money to do it. We did spend a lot of money. Everybody looks around and it's not done.
President was able to pass a program right after he came into office for 2 years. Wasn't as large a program as the one he hoped to pass because of opposition in the Congress, but he was able to pass a program. And if you look, you saw the sharpest turn in economic growth in the post-war period 6 months after that program went into effect. So it worked. The problem was that after 2 years, there was no will to renew it. We shifted to an obsession of the kind that I touched on earlier with the size of the national debt and with stopping growth in the national debt. And obsessed by that, we stopped being willing to make the investments. And we've systematically and ruthlessly cut back on public investment over the last 3 years. And we did it because the Congress would not support the spending. It is an enormous error on the part of the Congress. I think that it is connected to why Congress has an approval rating of 9%, less than half of the approval rating of the big banks, at a level where, as John McCain said, the only people who support you are your staff and your family.
But an awful lot of Americans are convinced that cleaning up that deficit is very important, that it's got to be done, that it's a burden on the future of the country that will drag us down regardless of what we do now.
The budget deficit was 11% of GDP in 2009. This year it will be 3% of GDP. Next year it will be 2.6% of GDP. That's less than it's been on average over the last generation and a half. We can do it, but the most important determinant of how successful we'll be in doing it is how fast we grow.
But you've still got lots of Republicans and, for that matter, a neutral arbiter saying it's going to go back up, and you've got this attitude. This was Oklahoma Republican Congressman Tom Cole on Monday talking about what's been done to bring it down, but the danger of it going back up. Tom Cole.
It's sort of like when you go on a diet, you know, and you lose the first 10 pounds, and it's great. I guess I can go out and splurge tonight, and you find out you really can't. You have to stay at it. So we're going to have to get a deficit reduction, which means entitlement reform at some point. Unfortunately, that's something the two sides have not been able to come together on.
Larry Summers was with me in the studio. You know that's still a big political message out there. And you know there's a lot of conservative economic pushback to your whole secular stagnation theory of what's going on. John Taylor out at Stanford calls it hokum, says it's just not what's happening.
It's excusing or trying to explain, I think, inadequately why the economy has recovered very slowly from this bad crisis we had a few years ago. Basically a big explanation, and it says that there's been some force out there that has made business investment more difficult, less attractive, and government needs to come in and fix that. So it's quite a story, I have to say. I've criticized it and called it hokum.
John Taylor at the Hoover Institute there. I mean, what about the fundamental critique of your analysis? And then this ongoing concern you heard from Tom Cole about the deficit, no matter.
My analysis, I think, speaks for itself. Growth has been slow. Even during the period before the financial crisis, we didn't have adequate growth except for the growth that was propelled by bubbles and financial instability. That's the core of, that's the core of the argument. When we acted on my premise, a growth, huge negative growth, immediately stopped and gave way to positive growth. When we went off the principles I'm recommending, that's when the stagnation set in after 2010. So the evidence of timing, the evidence of history, I think bears out the views that I'm expressing. What about growth in the debt? We don't know where the debt is going to be in 2035, and certainly that is something that needs attention.
There are a lot of scary projections.
They're scary projections, but you know, if you look at the range of error on those projections, the projections are for an increase in deficits of 1 or 2% of GDP. The range of error in those projections, the confidence interval, like when you say with a public opinion poll, plus or minus 3%, these are plus or minus about 6%. So there's enormous uncertainty in those projections. That's why we need to watch things carefully. But here's the thing that I think nobody stresses. If we are able to increase the growth rate of this economy by 0.2%, some people would say it was 0.3%. But between 2 and 0.3% for the next 75 years, that eliminates the entire deficit problem as it's now projected. And I ask you, which is a better strategy, a more positive strategy, a more politically attractive strategy, a strategy that will have greater other benefits? Doing all the things, tax reform, immigration reform, removal of barriers to private investment, necessary public infrastructure investment, to raise the growth rate by 0.25% a year, or to launch an attack on programs that are giving people $30,000 a year, $35,000 a year at maximum. At maximum, if you get the maximum Social Security benefit you possibly can get.
The entitlement reform push.
Social Security reform. The largest Social Security reform you get. You pay the maximum in every year for your whole lifetime. It's less than $40,000 a year. And so at a time of rising inequality, making the focus of our national effort to fix our economy be bearing down on Social Security beneficiaries, I just don't think is the right approach.
Go to Ben in Augusta, Georgia. Ben, you're on with Larry Summers. Thanks for calling, Ben.
Hey, Tom. Great show.
Thanks.
Hey, I'm a conservative, and I rarely believe much of what Larry says or along those lines. However, I do have to jump in and say, you know, the whole infrastructure piece that he was discussing is absolutely spot on. My biggest fear is, and I grew up in Washington, D.C., but lived in Colorado for a time. I was in the military. And my biggest fear is that whoever creates or develops the infrastructure is going to be given payoffs vis-a-vis cronyism and union cronyism. And case in point, when I lived in Colorado, the whole DIA thing is about, you know, 20 to 30 miles outside the highway there, the infrastructure of Denver itself. And yet all that land was purchased by Federico Pena and a variety of people under the table.
So you're worried that we'll do all the spending and we won't get the bang for the buck, that it will be misspent somehow, Ben?
Bang for the buck, and then also, you know, the union and the crony capitalism. You could even say, you know, some people would say that the marriage of those cronies with government is fascism. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, and it goes on the other side, too. It's Halliburton and Bush.
Yeah.
So, you know, my biggest concern is that it won't be fair. It'll be handouts. It'll be more entitlement giveaways. You know, it'll be robbing Peter, Paul, and Mary to pay John and Joe Q.
Ben, we've got it. I've got a break coming up. Let me take it to Larry Summers. I appreciate your call. Okay, Larry, there you've got a conservative. He's on the hook, but just barely. And you can hear he may wiggle off, and it's about confidence. You say, okay, we'll sign the check. You spend this money in infrastructure, and then it's crony, and then it's, you know, the wrong kind of spending. And for whatever reason, on the other side of all that spending, we don't end up with an economy that's in this great new place and ready to boom on its own. That it's, we've spent the money, and that confidence that it gets us somewhere great isn't there. Why? What about that?
He's right to worry. You know, in the infrastructure investment that we pursued in the first 2 years of the Obama administration, we made everything completely transparent on the web. The contract, the progress of every single project. And I think we now, with information technology, with the web, have a capacity to do these things with much more transparency than we used to, and I think sunlight is the best disinfectant.
But what about?
But you're absolutely right in your concern, and it's a very important one, and it goes to the kind of people you appoint. It goes to how much transparency there is.
But there's a deeper lack of confidence I hear in that question, that if you put in all this beautiful new infrastructure, that the American genius for innovation and new ideas and new fields opening up somehow won't be there this time. We're sort of tapped out. And even if you build all those great airports and beautiful highways and invest in those classrooms, it won't blossom on the other side. Is there something... Why do you think Americans don't believe it'll happen again?
Tom, you might be worried about that. Tom, with great respect, you may be worried about that. That was not what the question.
No, it
was about. At least as I heard it. But look, I think we're innovating at a fantastic rate. I mean, here you have a company, Facebook. It's celebrating its 10th anniversary right now. That company is worth more than the entire American automobile industry.
Peter Thiel says that's all kind of diddling around, diddling.
So we're certainly creating companies. If you look at how rapidly companies grow and enter the Fortune 500, it's four times as rapid as it was in 1960. Me, I don't take the ability to communicate with anyone else on this planet on my mobile telephone, more computing power than the Apollo project had.
So if we build it, it will come.
I think that's a great deal of innovation.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers about the U.S. economy, what it's going to take to really get it in gear again, whether we are stuck, and if we are, what to do about it. He says, well, big, big infrastructure spending. It'll make jobs. It'll lay the foundation for a new era of American growth. And with that, perhaps we address the deficit through growth, not cutting grandma's Social Security. Of course, there's big pushback on all of that in Washington. Larry, I want to go back to this issue of confidence in the future, and Americans just not certain whether the old formula is working anymore. Very smart guy I know. Every time I run into him, he looks out at the economy and he says, you know, something's changed, and what is it? He says he sees no net new jobs per unit of capital invested. It's just not happening for some reason. Now, I know you can put shovels in people's hands, and they can go and build roads and airports and all the rest. But what about the economy behind that and this notion that there's something fundamentally, intrinsically that's changed that is leading us to spinning our wheels, spending, but not creating net new jobs?
Tom, look, it's natural that people feel that way. Economic performance has been very poor for a long time. The financial crisis was immense in its impact on millions of Americans. So I don't want to be heard as some kind of Pollyanna. The question is, what do you do? What do you do to renew the economy and to restore a sense of confidence? And probably it's not just one thing, but it's almost certainly not sitting still. It's almost certainly not making the obsession of policy cutting Social Security benefits 20 years from now. That's not going to renew the economy today and create jobs. It's almost certainly got to do with causing there to be more demand for people to work today. Public investment is a very big start on that. Reducing a whole range of regulatory barriers to private investment is another important part of that. Doing the necessary kinds of R&D that will incubate the infrastructures of the future is another part of that. Recognizing that there are public responsibilities that are over time going to take more and more people, whether it's educating disadvantaged kids who are not learning to read in the United States, whether it's a healthcare system that still leaves millions without care. All of these things do the right thing and put people to work. I mean, make no mistake, there is plenty that needs to be done in our society. Look at the number of Americans who are poor. Look at the number of Americans who are not getting the educations they should have. There is plenty that needs to be done, and the task is to organize the system so that it gets done and more people can be working doing it. And we certainly have not been moving in the right direction for the last several years in doing those things. But the question is, should one succumb to fatalism? I don't think so. Should one simply frame to redefine the problem as something different, as being about debt decades from now? Or should we obsess about job creation and economic growth today?
You're not just an economist.
I believe we should do that.
Okay, you know your economics. You also know politics from time in Washington. If that view, that obsession, as you call it, is so wrong, what's driving it? There are very powerful people, factions, parties, who are really serious about that, what you call obsession. What is? They're not idiots. What? They're not fools. What do you think is driving it?
I think there are two things that are driving it. I think the more important thing is a misunderstanding that confuses private virtue and public virtue. If I save more, I'll pay down my debts and I'll build up my wealth. But if I save more, I'll spend less, and that'll mean that you and others have a lower income. Mm-hmm. And so what's good for the one, building up wealth, is bad for the many, because collectively, if we spend less, we have less income, and if we have less income, we end up saving less.
So maybe there's a misapprehension.
So I think there's a failure to understand what Keynes called the fallacy of composition. I think the second thing, and look, it's not that the deficit reduction efforts have been so politically powerful. The effort to control entitlements has not been a political success to date.
But they've been but big I think enough the to second, shut down but I think the government.
I think the second thing is that there has been a desire to discredit this president for political reasons. It began within weeks of his election. So there's a lot of politics in this. And I think the third thing is that, frankly, we live in a world where those who hold bonds, those who might stand to lose economically from government borrowing, are able to speak with a much louder megaphone than those who depend for their livelihood on Social Security or on Medicare.
Monette in Shelbyville, Tennessee. Monette, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Mr. Summers, do you assume any responsibility for the way that the economy has ended up when with you and Alan Greenspan and Timothy Geithner, when you shut Brooks Reborn down from what she was trying to do with the regulating the banks and all that? Do you assume any responsibility?
Larry Summers?
You know, it's a very complicated tale that we're not going to be able to get into here.
But a lot of listeners are asking a version of this question.
I think all of us who served in, who've been involved in one way or another in the financial sector, wish that we had foreseen all the things that took place in 2008 and been able to put in place preparations and contingencies that would have dealt more satisfactorily with those problems.
Were they an outgrowth of mistakes made by you in the 90s?
I think with respect, it is a very complicated tale. A wide variety of regulatory proposals that would have addressed many of the serious problems, putting derivatives on exchanges, doing something about predatory mortgages, fixing Fannie and Freddie, that I and others put forward during the 1990s were not accepted by the Congress. The Congress at that point was in the thrall of aggressive deregulationists who would only pass legislation in one direction.
Weren't you in their corner?
And of one kind. No, I was not in their corner with respect to a variety of proposals that I put forward, particularly with regard to predatory lending, but also with respect to other issues that were rejected. Now, I was not someone who was willing to oversimplify the issue into the view that all regulation is good and all reductions
foolish
in regulation are bad. And so there were measures that I believe were constructive that operated to reduce regulations that weren't functional. And I did support those in the 1990s. And I don't believe you can make a case that the regulations whose removal or adjustment I supported were contributors to the 2008 financial crisis,
the whole derivatives bubble
and
meltdown,
large way. There were important derivatives. There were important derivatives issues, but if you look at what was being done before the legislation and after the legislation, it is not that the legislation addressed the things that were at the center of those derivatives problems. The derivatives problems, Tom, had to do with what are referred to as credit default swaps.
Mm-hmm.
Credit default swaps essentially were in their very infancy at the time when the Clinton administration left office. The issues in derivatives were things that were entirely different during the time of the Clinton administration. The question is why nothing was done about credit default swaps and their various consequences over the subsequent 8 years. And that is an important question, but it's not one
now
that should be addressed to those of us who served during the Clinton administration.
Is that risk fixed today as we talk today? Are we still vulnerable to another 2008 kind of meltdown? You talk throughout here about the risk of that returning.
Generals always fight the last war. And there's always the risk that while a number of the particular issues that were pointed up by the 2008 crisis have been addressed, are there continuing risks of financial instability? Yes. Has the last word been written on regulation? No. Do we need to address, for example, a shadow banking system that is still very much in the shadows as far as regulation is concerned?
Swaps,
absolutely. Are there continuing challenges with respect to derivatives? Yes, there certainly are. But I do believe that important progress has been made, and I certainly was very pleased to have, looking back, to have been very strongly supportive of the appointment of Gary Gensler at the CFTC and of the various things that he was able to accomplish that I do think make the system safer than they were before.
Mike in Des Moines, Iowa is calling. Mike, you're on the air with Larry Summers.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, how do you address the notion that seems to be quite popular that there is a problem with wages in the United States, and it's because they haven't kept up with inflation, it's helped slow growth because there just isn't a lot of consumer spending?
Wages, income.
Look, first thing to do is to raise the minimum wage. President Obama is absolutely right about that, and it would make a meaningful contribution to increasing purchasing power. Second thing we've got to do is raise the demand for labor. If we had more people trying to hire workers, then workers would be able to command higher wages. When there are millions of people unemployed, that obviously is going to put downwards pressure on wages. And so the best way to strengthen wages is to build a stronger economy, and that comes back to supporting investments, as I talked about earlier.
Inequality. It's not hard to see how hyper-inequality can be a problem for democracy. It skews power. But what about economically? There's a conservative argument that it doesn't really matter in economic terms. You know, let it be there. Is it a problem economically?
One of our problems is a shortage of spending power. And we know from everyday observation, from logic, and from statistical studies that when you give a dollar to somebody with an income of $40,000, they're going to spend a larger part of that dollar than when you give a dollar to somebody with an income of $4 million. And so one of the effects of rising inequality is to take down spending power. And lack of spending power is obviously one of the things that's holding back the economy.
Why aren't the big corporations letting loose that $2.5 trillion you're talking about? Why aren't they putting the gas in the tank that you're saying the government might have to do?
Some of it is tax rules that give them a very strong incentive to keep their cash abroad, which means they can't spend it in the United States. And that's why tax reform is an important issue. Some of it is a lack of confidence in whether there'll be customers there if they expand their capacity. Businesses do things to meet demand. And if there isn't demand, businesses will do much less. I think that's the most important thing. I think there are also areas where regulation comes into it and where it's going to take a very long time to get the requisite approvals, and people are less willing to make investments where there are going to be long delays.
Is it possible that technology takes us into a situation where growth just doesn't produce jobs anymore, where robots are doing everything? They're driving the trucks and they're, you know, you name it, just on front after front, there they are. Is it possible we have to make it some kind of deeper recalculation about how we produce value and share it?
There's no question that technology is going to have – has had large effects and quite possibly will have even larger effects in the future on the nature of work. But it needs to be remembered that technology does replace certain kinds of jobs. It also creates a variety of kinds of jobs. Think of the people who trade in large scale on eBay and are able to move merchandise and inventory in a way that wouldn't have ever been possible. Think about the people who are enabled by Square to take a credit card and engage in a financial transaction who previously would have been unable to do that. Think about the fact that we have more complex and difficult educational needs than we've ever had before, and part of where people are going to work is meeting those kinds of needs.
Stakes. President Obama has three more years. There doesn't seem to be any sign that I can see that Congress is going to come around and support the kind of huge public investment that you're calling for. We've just got 1 minute. If it's not made, what are the stakes here? What are the risks?
The risks are that we grow slower than we need to, that we become more discouraged about our future, that a generation of young people leaving school don't get on the kinds of upward escalator career paths that you and I were fortunate enough to, that the American example loses its power around the world, that we, in a world that is still very dangerous, lose our will as a country to support a peaceful global system, and that ultimately Americans don't live the lives that they could if we do what's necessary.
Those are pretty broad stakes. Janet Yellen stepping into the Fed, you're not. What's your one word of advice to her?
Prudence. And I'm sure she'll bring it.
Larry Summers, former Treasury Secretary, thank you very much for being with us this hour. Great to have you here. Listeners, thanks for joining us. Coming up tomorrow, our news of the week in review. Join us for that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.